This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And we begin this week, as we have too many times before, with the pain and trauma of more mass shootings in America. More than 30 lives were cut short in two separate massacres in Dayton, Ohio and El Paso, Texas, over the weekend. We're going to talk about what that means, but first, we want to take time to remember those who were brutally shot and killed, beginning with Ohio.
Lois Oglesby, 27, was a mother of two who just returned to nursing school from maternity leave.
Megan Betts was 22 years old, a college student at Wright State University studying earth and environmental sciences. She was also the sister of the shooter.
Saeed Saleh was 38 years old.
Derek Fudge, 57, from Springfield, Ohio, was visiting Dayton's Oregon District with his son.
Logan Turner, a machinist, was out with his friends celebrating his 30th birthday.
Nicholas Coomer was completing an internship at Dayton's Maple Tree Cancer Alliance. The 25-year-old had planned to return to St. Francis University to complete his master's degree in cancer care.
Thomas McNichols lived in Dayton and was the father of two daughters and two sons, 2 to 8 years old. A factory worker, he was 25 and went by the nickname TJ.
Monica Brickhouse lived in Virginia Beach and worked as a recovery specialist. In her spare time, she ran an event planning and catering company, Two Good Girls. She was 39.
Beatrice Nicole Warren Curtis was 36 and lived in Carrollton, Virginia. She was friends with Monica Brickhouse.
In the border town of El Paso, Texas, 22 are confirmed dead at a shooting at a Walmart. El Paso authorities have not yet released the names of the victims there, but Mexico's Secretary of Foreign Relations released the names of 8 Mexican citizens killed.
Sara Esther Regalado from Ciudad Juarez.
Adolfo Cerros Hernandez from Aguascalientes.
Jorge Calvillo Garcia from Torreon.
Elsa Mendoza de la Mora from Yapomera.
Gloria Irma Marquez from Ciudad Juarez.
Maria Eugenia Legarreta Roth from Chihuahua.
Ivan Filiberto Manzano from Ciudad Juarez.
Juan de Dios Velasquez Chavez from Zacatecas.
As soon as we have the rest of the names from El Paso, we will bring them to you here on Radio Boston. And I should also note that more than 24 people were injured in El Paso, and at least 27 were injured in Dayton. As we go forward today, we want to hear from you. Are we now a nation of survivors? How are you thinking about and coping with the events over the weekend? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now on the line is Dr. Gene Baresin, professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, and he's the executive director of the Clay Center for Young Healthy Minds at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Baresin, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm sorry to have you under these circumstances,
Doctor.
Here we are again.
Yeah.
What's your initial reaction?
Oh, it's horrifying. This is shocking. It's tragic. It's and here we go again. You know, it's just like you said, you know, you're having me back again, but, you know, I'm called in this horrifying situation. I think the country is reeling. I think people are afraid. They're angry. They're shocked. And as a child psychiatrist, I'm particularly worried about how parents can reassure our children that it is it's safe, and that they can actually go to school and go to Walmart and go to the malls and go out without having to live in fear.
What is your advice to parents about how to talk to their children about the tragedies from this weekend and the ones that have come before that?
Well, all children of all ages want to know 3 fundamental things. You know, am I safe? Are you, the people who are taking care of me, safe? And how is this going to affect my daily life? And I think parents need to think about the developmental levels of their kids. So for toddlers and preschoolers, they're more concerned about the parents' reactions. So for all parents, put the life mask on you first, just like the attendants at the airplanes will tell you. Take care of yourself, because the youngsters, preschoolers, are going to be picking up on your anxiety. And for them, I would just reassure them that everything is fine and turn off the TV. For school-age kids, they have access to media. They have smartphones. They have computers. They're hearing about this in the news, but they see the world in black and white terms, and they see the world as good guys and bad guys. And for them, we want to ask them questions. What are you worried about? We want to ask all the kids questions like that. But for them, we want them to know that there are more good people in this nation than there are folks who do these horrifying things. I would recommend we turn off the TV for the school age kids too, and let them and talk with them, and they'll work it out through their play and through conversation with you. For teenagers and young adults, they're old enough to get it, and they're worried about their future, and they're worried about whether this is going to happen to them in high school or in college. For them, it's important to ask them what they've heard and what they've seen, because who knows what our kids see through various media and digital media channels. But they can actually sit and watch the news with the adults and ask questions. And we can ask questions about safety and justice and security and why folks would do something like this. They're much more sophisticated. They are eager to talk. And so for kids of all ages, let them ask the questions, know what's on their mind, know what they've heard, and help comfort them and correct any misperceptions that they may have.
Thanks, Dr. Bresson. I want to bring a second voice into this. We have here in the studio Father J. Brian Hare, Secretary of Health and Social Services for the Archdiocese of Boston, also a professor of the practice of religion and public life at the Harvard Kennedy School. Father Hare, thanks for joining us, too.
I'm delighted to be here, but not for this reason.
Yeah. Dr. Bresson has talked about how the community of a family begins to talk about and process what's happened. Do we have collective or community trauma, too? And how do we as a community, a larger community, also begin to talk and process and engage with each other at this level of hurt and tragedy?
Well, I think we often talk about the country as a family, at least we have in the past, have talked about to try and think about the country as having relationships of different kinds than blood ties, but that tie the country together. Now, the question is, how do we talk to one another? Unfortunately, at this moment in time, I think we're having a harder time talking to each other than we have at other moments in history. As I thought about coming on to this program this afternoon, and as I just heard Dr. Talking about people's sense of fear, I think I remember very clearly I was here in the studio after 9/11. And after 9/11, the country experienced a kind of vulnerability because of external threats, and we had to find a way to talk about that. Now we're talking about vulnerability from internal threats, and to some degree, it appears to me it's more complicated, if you will, because in a sense, what we're trying to deal with is a fundamental characteristic of American society, and that's our pluralism. So if we're going to talk to each other, we're going to have to find ways to talk across lines of different ethnic backgrounds, different racial backgrounds, different religious backgrounds, different political senses of what's right and wrong. And so this family discussion, if it is to be one, has to speak within the context of something we define ourselves of, and that is one of the most pluralistic societies in the world. So how do we talk about fear and vulnerability when the topic is not someone from outside who threatens us, but it happens to be forces inside that threaten us?
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation with Father Hare and Dr. Bresson. Let's take some calls. Ida from Worcester, what's on your mind today?
Well, the question that I heard to start was, how do you feel? How are you feeling about these horrible incidents that have occurred? And like most people, or like many people, I'm scared. I'm scared because I'm not a young person, and yet I see our society degrading with people feeling emboldened to show hatred and act on hatred that perhaps they had within them all along, but now they feel that they can act on it. And the gun violence is horrible, but it's not the only piece of it. We see a lot of it without gun violence, but it's the same kind of deep-seated hatred that people now feel somehow it's all right. I put a lot of the blame squarely on our president for the way he talks and degrades people. And that's part of what allows people to say, well, it's okay to hate. It's okay to denigrate the person standing next to you or make fun of a crippled person. It's horrible. I think that's the conversation that we all really need to have, that we say that is not acceptable. It's not that it's not normal. It's not acceptable, and we're not willing to accept it. We have to end that type of talk, and I think it starts right at the top.
Thanks for that call, Ida. Yeah, thank you. And let's take one more call. We'll hear from Mary in Hyde Park. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi, Tiziana. Hi, Father Hare. I want to answer your question about are we a nation of survivors? We are. We are a nation of survivors now because we are creating a traumatic culture of fear. I am a gun violence survivor. This weekend, I was attending a leadership conference where we had representatives from all 50 states, 2,000 gun violence prevention leaders. And in the middle of our conference, we heard the news of this massacre, and hundreds of us chose to abandon the regularly scheduled program and march to the White House and march to the Capitol. But I have to say, when I hear people say, I'm horrified, it's bewildering, it's terrible, you know, it's predictable is what it is. I'm not horrified. It's predictable. It's preventable. We are choosing this. Every other high-income country in the world has mental health problems. Every other country, every other peer nation to the United States has video games. The only difference is access to guns and access to weapons of war. There are more guns than people. And I know you can hear how upset I am in my voice.
I can, Mary. I can.
I really believe we are wreaking violence on our children by making them go through lockdown drills. It doesn't even matter if a shooter comes to their school now because we are traumatizing them by saying the adults don't know what's going on and we're going to put you through this even though we have the power to change our culture. No, we're going to make you lock yourself in
so,
the closet.
Mary,
well,
this is violence
to ourselves.
Mary, I don't want to interrupt you, especially knowing that you have an experience as a survivor, and I am grateful for your call, but you have raised questions that I want to help listeners process. And so I want to turn to Dr. Baresin now to ask for just your general reactions to what you've just heard, Doctor.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for those comments, I think it's impressive that a survivor will speak so clearly about this. I agree that we're in a particularly difficult problem state in the United States, and I think that there is not one single simplistic answer to this state of affairs. We have more firearms and assault rifles than any other country in the world. Estimates are from 5 to 10 million circulating in the United States. There's no purpose for an assault rifle that can kill scores of people in seconds. Hunters would not use it. It has nothing to do with our right to bear arms. I totally understand that argument. The other is that we have unfettered use of digital media that we've never seen before. We have no idea how to regulate it. There's been a lot of debate, and from the highest offices to everyday use of digital media. Cyberbullying, for example, is a form of violence, and it's escalated. Teenagers, anywhere from 15 to 59% of our teenagers and youth experience cyberbullying, which can be devastating because it literally does go viral. It's not just being called a name when the schoolyard or being beaten up after school. It's quite powerful, and it can be an important force of generating hate and lack of real-time discussion. I want to downplay the blaming of mental illness because certainly I can't say anything about the shooters, but frankly, 20% of our population carries a psychiatric diagnosis of one kind or another. That's a very large number, and it's unpredictable which individual is actually going to be a perpetrator. The fact of the matter is that folks from youth to old age that have emotional problems are more likely to be the victims of violence than blame. So then pulling the mental health card is really way out of line. So I think we need to approach all of these areas with sensitivity, with thoughtfulness, and to bring them out in our community settings.
Let me pick up there, Dr. Bressin,
yes,
bringing this out in our community settings, and I'm going to turn back to Father Hare.
Yes.
So Dr. Bressin did a thorough and thoughtful job of responding to our second caller, who was angry, who had had her own experience, who went to Washington. Our first caller talked about hate and where we are. So what's the companion piece to not demonizing mental illness, to approaching gun control? What is the companion piece to this deeper river of hate that we hear so many people feel like they're experiencing?
Well, I think when we start to talk about hate, we're talking about the internal makeup of the person, not in terms of mental health necessarily.
No.
Doctors made the point. But in terms of hate is a possibility as a human reaction to situations. So we're talking about something deep-seated that can be catalyzed in human beings. It also can be redirected by a multiplicity of remedies, if you will. Partly it's education. Partly it's a sense of recognizing the value in different kinds of people, in different kinds of political, cultural, ethnic backgrounds. So I think hate is a potential in any human situation, and we've seen it played out throughout the last century at both the local level and the national and global level. So how to deal with hate? Well, in part, hate is also a characteristic, a moral characteristic, a distorted moral characteristic. So part of the reason we do, part of the way we deal with hate is to ask what are its sources, what sparks it from the outside that allows it to build up on the inside. And that's where I think the wisdom of what we've already heard is that there is no single answer to this question. There is no single bullet. It is not all about mental health. It is not all about guns, and it's not all about the internet. On the other hand, there's no single agency that we can turn to. So I think we ought to expect a lot more from our political process than we've seen on this question, but we also ought not to overestimate what the political process by itself can do. Obviously, education at every level is fundamental. Obviously, coming from the religious community, we need to assume responsibility for how we deal with the question of the potential of hate in a society and the potential of love as an equally deep, equally able to be catalyzed in human beings. Hate has no corner on the market of what kind of people we can be. Love is at least as possible a response as hate is, and we need to understand how many different ways we can cultivate that characteristic.
We're going to take a break in a minute, but before we do, I'd like to hear from at least one more caller. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's talk to Catherine from Cohasset. Catherine, go ahead.
Hello, Tiziana. Thank you for this discussion. I listen to these discussions all the time, TV, radio, I read it in the newspaper, op-eds, everything. I just cannot understand. I don't know how we get through to our legislators. They need to step back enough to see the big picture. And the big picture is that my right as an American citizen to own an instrument of death is now, from a public policy perspective, more sacred than my right not to be murdered while minding my own business. And I cannot and will not ever understand that.
Catherine, I hear your anger. I think so many people are angry and frustrated now. Just after the break, we're actually going to hear from a state legislator who is talking about this specifically. So if you can sort of sit with that anger through the break, I think we're going to have more conversation for you when we come back. Dr. Jean Baresson, the professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, stay with us, please. And Father Brian Hare, Secretary of Health and Social Services for the Archdiocese of Boston, please stay with us as well. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with more Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this hour we're talking about the two mass shootings that took place this weekend. Before the break, we discussed how the natural reaction for many people is a strong desire for action. We heard a caller just before the break who expressed great frustration about action in Congress. Here in Massachusetts, one way lawmakers have attempted to do something is with a red flag law, which Governor Baker signed into law last July. President Trump called for similar legislation on a national level earlier today, and South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham said in a statement that he has reached a deal with Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal on a bipartisan bill to establish red flag protection order laws. Joining us now on the line is State Representative Marjorie Decker, who sponsored Massachusetts' red flag bill. Representative Decker, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, and thank you for keeping this conversation going.
I appreciate that. Representative, what is your reaction to the weekend shootings?
So I find myself surprised that my reaction at this point is really I've completely bypassed sadness, and I'm straight to anger and determination. And I spent the weekend pulling together information that actually shows, in fact, states are no longer waiting or depending or hoping on Congress to take action, although that needs to happen. And Trump and Graham's words will continue to be hollow until they actually show leadership and laws that pass that we know save lives. Massachusetts has the most comprehensive gun ownership, gun safety laws in the country. And what it shows is there's a direct correlation to those laws and the lowest number of gun homicides. But we're not an island, and so even in Massachusetts, people are still having their lives ripped away from them by guns that are being purchased and brought in out from outside of Massachusetts.
Representative Decker, so it sounds like you're saying there are things that states can do in the absence of the national government, of the national legislature taking action. Tell us, the red flag law was passed, to your point, in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Can you explain a little more about what it does?
Yeah. So now 15 states have a red flag bill, also known as extreme risk protection order. It means now that it's very clear what to do if somebody in your home has a gun and you think they're going to turn it on themselves and hurt themselves, or they're going to turn it on someone else and hurt them. You can go straight to a judge and you can ask for an extreme risk protection order. And we know that in about a year, there's been 20 of them that have been filed in Massachusetts, and 14 of them were done as emergencies. So we know in Massachusetts, we're already saving lives. Connecticut has had this on the books for years, and we know that a study that was done about 2 or 3 years ago showed that over 70 people's lives were saved from suicide because of this law. So we know a red flag bill saves lives. We know it's a tool, but we also know it's a tool that is wrapped in many other common sense gun laws that Massachusetts has passed, primarily as the aftermath of Sandy Hook. Speaker DeLeo really took this issue and said, we're going to show, in fact, that it's not rocket science, it's political will.
And
the Massachusetts legislature led.
And yet, Representative Decker, this was not without significant pushback for you personally. I mean, didn't you receive death threats after you sponsored the red flag law bill?
Yeah, so it's important to remember that when I testified on my bill 3 months before the bloodshed and the massacre of Parkland high school students and teachers, just testifying on the bill was enough for the local NRA, which is known as GOAL, as well as the national NRA, to take my testimony and to really gaslight, to really use it as a way of amping up their own fundraising and amping up all of the fear and the anxiety that they drill into their members, believing that we're just trying to thoughtlessly take away people's guns. Which it was never about that, but I was threatened. We had police detail. This is their MO. We're going to intimidate, scare you, bully you, and silence you so you will just continue to let us you know, have free reign, sell our guns, make a lot of money, and watch us while we kill your children and your family.
All right, well, let's listen to Jim Wallace. He's the executive director of Gun Owners Action League. He told BUR, this is an argument that it doesn't seem as much rooted in threat and intimidation as wrong approach. Let's listen to what he said in response to the red flag law.
If you truly believe somebody is the next mass murderer, why would you just simply take their Second Amendment civil rights away and send them home? That's just ludicrous, but that's what Massachusetts did.
What do you say to that criticism, Representative Decker?
You know, I think Jim Wallace is becoming, you know, he's becoming just by the wayside. People are no longer listening to the nonsense of his NRA talking points. The only time the NRA actually talks about or raises the issue of mental health issues is to oppose. Why would you allow someone who you think was going to hurt them or hurt themselves have a gun? Jim never answers that question. And I want to just be really clear. Other countries around the world have people who have mental health issues, and they do not have they do not have the rampant mass shootings that we have had. And if you want to talk about mental health issues, then let's talk about that and let that be a different conversation, because every day in this country, children and adults sit in waiting rooms of emergency rooms because they can't get the help they need because their insurance coverage doesn't actually treat it like they do your teeth or your eyes or your body. So let's talk about mental health parity. Let's talk about access to mental health care, where you need it, when you need it. Let's talk about reducing the stigma. What Jim Wallace is doing is trying to distract us and not answer the question, which is, is there ever an appropriate time to remove somebody temporarily or permanently from their firearms?
So,
Representative, that's the question he doesn't want to answer.
So I want to just take our attention to the national level for just a second before we let you go, Representative. Today, President Trump actually called for national red flag law. So obviously taking the Massachusetts concept and a concept from other states that have done it. Could a red flag law work on a national level?
You know, of course it could, right? It's about ensuring that people have the opportunity and they know where to go, that someone can quickly evaluate whether or not, based on their own fears and evidence, that somebody should be temporarily removed from their firearm so they can't hurt themselves or hurt others. But there's also a lot of other things that we can do at the national level. I want to be clear, red flag is important, and it's a tool, and it's saving lives. So that's like the least of what they can do. In addition to passing the red flag law, we could be doing looking at universal background checks. We could actually be looking at bringing back the assault weapons ban. In El Paso and Dayton, the guns that were used there could never have been purchased in Massachusetts. It is easier to get a driver's license. It's easier to get a gun license in many of these states than it is to get a driver's license. If we're serious about this and they actually want to take some leadership and save lives, they can do that. But until then, people should take comfort. I heard your caller earlier. 17 months after Parkland happened, after the massacre happened there, we had 110 responsible gun ownership laws that were passed around the country. In 2019, 22 states passed 47 gun safety bills. In 2018, 69 state legislative bills were passed. And overwhelmingly around the country, legislatures are rejecting by 80 to 90% bills that have been backed by the NRA. So people are moving. Legislatures around the country are starting to take lead with Massachusetts that has moved the way and show the country you can actually support someone's rights to own a firearm responsibly, to be trained, and to have a background checked, and they can still have all of that, and yet we can still reduce gun homicides and gun violence.
All right.
And Massachusetts residents need other states to do this, because in the first 6 months of 2019, in Boston alone, 18 people were killed.
Representative
Decker,
we're
not an island.
Thank you so much. So you say that the people of Massachusetts, we have many of them on the line, and so I need to let you go because I want to let more callers bring their voices in. Massachusetts State Representative Marjorie Decker, who filed Massachusetts Red Flag Law, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate you joining us. In a minute, I'm going to turn to another guest, a history professor, to provide some context. But first, let's listen to a few callers. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jay from Quincy, go ahead.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead, Jay.
Great, thank you. First of all, great fan. I'm a fan of the show. And,
thank you.
The guest mentioned earlier about video game, and I'm a guy in my late 20s, so I feel like I can sort of, I'm in the same age group as the shooter, so to speak. And video game, I think, is an interesting thing because you don't really take cues from video game. I don't think video games are evil. There are video games out there that teach people how to drive fast car, do all the crazy stuff, but you don't see anyone racing down the street and try to run anyone over with their cars. So if I don't think video game is the problem, what is the problem? What I do think is that we grew up in an Instagram and social media time where people kind of prompt each other into hating each other. What I mean by that is...
Actually, Jay, I'm going to stop you there. Your video game point was a really important one, but I do want to give a couple of other callers an opportunity, too. Thank you for calling. Let me hear from Louise from East Boston as well. Louise, please go ahead.
Hi. I just want to continue the conversation about the hate.
Okay.
We have a president who's very overtly and outward about his hate. I also have to wonder, though, about the Congress. They are unwilling to work with people and even talk with people who they disagree with. And is that also raising and encouraging people to dislike and even hate people? And what part is that playing in this whole conversation?
Thanks for raising that question, Louise. It's an important one, and I appreciate it. We're going to take one more call. Ron from Stoughton. Ron, go right ahead.
Hi. One thing that's been occurring to me throughout this tragedy is that we seem to be falling into the notion that there's two conversations to be had, one about hate and one about the proliferation of guns and violence in the culture. In fact, if you learn about the history of the Second Amendment, it turns out the history of the Second Amendment is not separate from the notions of white supremacy that were part of our country at its founding. The Second Amendment was intended to protect the right of states to organize militias to put down potential slave riots or to confront Native Americans. And part of the conversation, I think, has been cut short or been less than fully honest, because we talk about the need for guns to be protected under the Second Amendment as if it's all about hunting or it's about protecting one's home. In fact, the history of the Second Amendment was much more sinister than that.
That's perfect.
And we
transition.
Need to address the issues as they interrelate with one another.
Perfect, Ron. That's the perfect transition, actually, to our next guest. I'm going to say thank you and bring in some historical perspective, because we're going to turn to Heather Cox Richardson. She's a history professor at Boston College and author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party, and also a larger history of the country, the Civil War, et cetera. Heather, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's always a pleasure.
Did you hear that call, Heather?
I did. I heard the last several.
So what are your reactions, especially to what we just heard from Ron?
Well, the history of the Second Amendment is important. I also think the larger points that were made by the caller previous to that, and then from Jay from Boston as well, the idea of there being these sort of voices, especially in an Instagram or a Facebook culture, that whip people up in a mob is a really important question, because it leads to the larger issue of why. Like, why are we in this moment that is completely insane? If you came down from Mars and looked at America and looked at the fact that we have this epidemic of gun deaths, and every time it happens, there's a number of people who say, well, it's, you know, mental health issues, or it's, you know, anything except the actual culprit, which is the proliferation of guns and a number of voices that support that as part of a political agenda, they would, you know, a Martian would look at this and say, this is crazy. You've got an obvious problem. Why are you letting it happen? And at the end of the day, the reason that we are letting it happen is because a political party, the Republican Party, has made the Second Amendment and gun ownership a cultural touch point for their followers.
So, Professor Heather,
the moment we're looking at this.
So, Professor Heather Cox Richardson, we have had guns for a few hundred years. We arguably have had other times in America's history of great anger and hate and division inside the country. What does make this different, or is it not different?
There are some ways in which it is similar. There are some ways in which it is absolutely unique. But let me start with the fact that we've had guns forever. I'm from a gun-owning culture myself. I'm from rural Maine. I actually grew up learning about gun safety with the NRA. And what happened is in the 1980s, late 70s, the NRA made a very conscious shift from going from gun safety and promoting gun ownership and hunting as a sport. Actually, you know, America has a very good shooting team. Most people don't know that.
I did not know that.
We tend to win the Olympics again and again. It just doesn't show up on the news. They went from promoting that to very consciously making the decision to go away from promoting gun ownership and gun safety toward promoting gun manufacturing and ammunition manufacturing. And in 1980, for the first time ever, they endorsed a political candidate. That was Ronald Reagan. And the ownership of guns became central to the culture of the post-1980 Republican Party. So gun ownership is nothing new, but the meaning of gun ownership has changed really dramatically. As late as the 1970s, gun ownership was about skill. It was about sometimes protection for your home. It was about hunting. Then it became part of, I need this because this is what it means to be an individualist American man who's going to stand behind a nationalism that's promoted by people like Ronald Reagan and the Republican Party as it expanded from there. It's a really interesting story.
So, Heather, I want to take a call. We've got a caller who I think is may challenge that a little bit, and I want to get this voice in. Josh from Plymouth, please go ahead.
Hey, thank you for having me and inviting me to the conversation. I just wanted to touch back on the Second Amendment. And I think it's often misunderstood, and there's a lot of narratives that fit, you know, a fashionable viewpoint. Today, the fashion is the evils of white supremacy. The Second Amendment was actually a result, a direct result of the Founding Fathers realizing that an unarmed populace was at the mercy of a tyrannical government. Just having come out of the Revolutionary War, and having Great Britain as a foreign power and having very little ability to resist, I think that's why it was enshrined in our Constitution and has nothing to do with fighting Indians and slave uprisings. I find that to be an interesting narrative, but it's more about a populace having the ability to resist a tyrannical government.
Thanks for that call, Josh. I'm going to turn it back over to Heather Cox Richardson to address that. I also, editorially, I want to say, to the extent that we are, in fact, talking about white supremacy, there is a dark side to that, and I don't want us to dismiss that either. But Heather Cox Richardson, let me turn this back over to you.
Well, yes, certainly there are a lot of things going on when the founders write the Second Amendment, but like the Electoral College, you can't very well look in 2019 and act as if there is a straight line and that we have to look at this the same way the founders did. For one thing, the technology is so different than it is now. It used to take a really skilled marksman almost 40 seconds to load a gun between the Revolution and 1861. So we're just talking about a completely different thing when we now have semi-automatic weapons. But while we are talking right now about the Second Amendment and guns, there is also the other side of that, which is the question of the anger and the hate that your callers talked about, but also the layer that I want to add, which is why. Why is this happening now, and how is it going to play out? Because what I see is a really interesting moment right now where the use of guns and the meaning of guns has become part of a political identity, and it's a political identity that is currently being stoked on Instagram, as your man from Boston said, on Facebook, and especially by Congress, as another one of your callers said, and by today's president. This is a really bad mix. The 24 hours where we had two mass shootings felt to me like a turning point, where a lot of people said, you know, this has gone
on way
too long.
Just very briefly, what about it as a turning point? I'm going to lose you in just a minute, so I want to hear from you on that before we go.
The turning point, it seems to me, from what I am hearing, is that a lot of people who in the past maybe could look away because it didn't seem to affect their lives suddenly have woken up to the idea that maybe things have gone too far, that this is one straw too many. You saw two fairly minor, it's true, but two card-carrying Republican members, elected members of state organizations in the last 24 hours saying, we have a problem with guns, we have a problem with white supremacy, we must do something about that. That's the first crack in the Republican ranks that we have seen. Other people have left the party to criticize it. They have stayed within it to criticize it.
I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you. We have to go to a break. That's Boston College History Professor Heather Cox Richardson. Heather, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more coming. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are having a real community conversation here today about the shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio over the weekend, which killed more than 30 people. Still with us here in the studio is Father Brian Hare, Secretary of Health and Social Services for the Archdiocese of Boston and Professor of the Practice of Religion and Public Life at the Harvard Kennedy School. Father Hare, thanks for staying with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Also still on the line is Dr. Jean Baresson, Professor of Psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School and Executive Director of the Clay Center for Young Healthy Minds at Mass General Hospital. Thank you, Dr. Baresson.
Thank you for having me.
And you're still with us, callers. We want you to keep calling, please. What's on your mind today? How are you processing what we experienced collectively over the weekend? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got so many voices today. So what I want to do is I'm going to grab two more calls who have been waiting for a while, and then I'm going to turn to Dr. Baresson and Father Hare for some reactions to everything we've been discussing. Let's listen to Howard from West Newbury. Howard, what's on your mind?
Yes, hi. I'm angry like everybody else, but my question or comment is really involves the media and the role of the media. And I'm specifically wondering why we aren't shown the images, graphic and horrific and grisly as they may be, of the reality of these massacres. Let the American people see what an assault weapon can do to first graders or to high school students or adults, and I think we need to see, and I think the people will be outraged, and an outraged populace is what Congress fears most.
Thank you for that, Howard. I appreciate your call. Julie from Dover, you're with us too. Go ahead.
Hi. I have 2 points. The first is that if your two children were fighting and you noticed that there was something dangerous, you know, within reach, you would pull it away from them. We have 129 guns per 100 people in this country. That is a mistake. It's just too many. And therefore, when there's danger, there's serious danger. The other point that I wanted to make is
actually, Julie, I'm going to ask you to stick to just the first point. It's an important one, and we have a lot of voices, and I don't want to lose that first point. So thank you for that. I'm going to turn straight to Dr. Baresson for reactions to those two calls and anything else you've heard in the last few minutes.
Well, I've heard a lot. First of all, one of the things about showing the violence on television, we've learned that if we sensationalize, we glamorize, we cover it with suicide in a certain way, there'll be copycat phenomena. One of the things we have to be very careful about is covering mass shootings and homicides in a way that can actually fan the flames. Copycat phenomenon has been a proven fact for adolescent suicide. We don't know the data for homicides, but I think we have to be very careful about what we show in the media and how we use the media. Second thing I'd like to say, just in general, that has not been mentioned, is that one of the things that came out of Parkland, one of the things that have come out that's really been very healing and helpful, and I'm sure the Father can comment on this as well, is when communities of people come together and bond and engage each other and converse with each other and provide comfort and solace and action. Doing things together. People want to do things. Coming together as a community is really important. We human beings are pack animals. You know, we engage with each other and we garner strength and love from a community. And I would like to see more of that.
Let's have Father Hare build on that. Thank you, Dr. Baresson. Go ahead, Father Hare.
Well, we started off by talking about the show about are we survivors? Well, there are two dimensions to that. We're afraid right now, and so we feel like we are in danger of being survivors. On the other hand, if we had a sense of ourselves and our country's history, we have faced even bigger problems than this problem, and we have survived it. And so we need to have confidence we can do that again. Secondly, to go back to Representative Decker, who obviously has given our state a great gift, I'm delighted to hear how other states have taken this up. One of our Supreme Court justices once said, the state is the laboratory for policy. But we cannot underestimate the significance of the Congress. And so this, to my mind, is fundamental for the step forward. If we can't get intelligent, binding legislation out of the Congress, as good as the states are, this country's too big to not deal with. Finally, there's the question of leadership. And leadership today is crucial. We talk to each other locally. We have to do that, give people places to talk. But if we don't get leadership on this, and a different kind of leadership than we've heard recently in terms of castigating people, denigrating people, think of what Lincoln did in the second inaugural after the Civil War.
It was not castigation.
That kind of leadership today. And if some people don't provide it, other people have to.
All right. I want to bring one more community voice in. This is Marian Davis. She's a spokesperson for MIRA, the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition. We're reaching her on her cell from Worcester. Marian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Marian, Especially after what we saw in the intention, we believe, of the shooting in El Paso, what is your reaction and the reaction of the MIRA Coalition?
We're horrified. This is exactly what people have been afraid of all along. If you keep sowing hate, if you keep speaking about immigrants as if they were invaders, as if they were a threat to this country, if you keep just stoking all sorts of horrible, ugly passions in people, at some point somebody's going to pick up a gun and go do something terrible. And that's exactly what happened. This is sadly completely predictable, and it's sickening. And we need to call it out for what it is. This was an act of terrorism. This was an act of white nationalism. And it is just the next natural step, considering the really hateful and horrible things that everybody from the president to his, you know, some of his key cabinet members to a lot of his supporters at rallies have been saying.
So, Marian, you used the word terrorism, which is an important word in the context of this weekend. We spoke to someone from the Chelsea Collaborative earlier today who told us that there were concerns about undocumented immigrants even contacting loved ones that they feared might have been hurt because they were afraid. They were afraid of being flagged by immigration authorities. Are you hearing anything about that kind of fear?
We haven't heard about it directly, but there were definitely a lot of concerns that, you know, that were circulating among people, immigrant advocates in Texas, that there might have been some people who were shot or who were otherwise injured who didn't dare to go to the hospital and forget about the police to even go to the hospital. And that is very consistent, again, with what we've been seeing now for 2.5 years. Under this administration, the Trump administration has made it clear that they want immigrants to feel afraid every day, that they want them to be afraid of the police, that they want them to be afraid of anything official. And people internalize that fear, and it's really wrecking lives every day.
Marian, just very briefly, you are taking time from a democracy training today that the MIRA Coalition does. Can you briefly tell us about what that is?
What this is a wonderful tradition that MIRA has been doing for several years, where we train we bring together a group of community activists, and we have right now people from, you know, teenagers who are still in high school all the way to people in their 50s who just want to get involved in their communities. And we train them about some of the biggest issues happening at the state level. And also sometimes we talk about what are some of the challenges in their communities. And then we help them figure out how they can get involved and how they can organize in their own community and how they can make an impact. And it's really powerful, and it's really grown our movement.
I got to cut you off there. I'm so sorry, Marian. That's Marian Davis, spokesperson for MIRA, the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Coalition. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Secretary of Health and Social Services Father Brian Hare, Archdiocese of Boston, and also a professor of the Practice for Religion and Public Life at the Harvard Kennedy School. Thank you. And Dr. Jean Baresson, professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and executive director of the Clay Center for Young Healthy Minds at Mass General Hospital. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hey, that's our show for today. Thanks for tuning in. Join us tomorrow for more Radio Boston.